Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. Back-to-back comedy series premiere Monday night on BYU TV. The Parker Andersons go first, followed by Amelia Parker. There's more connection beyond the titles, as you'll learn when executive producer Mark Bishop joins me next. Basheri Chung, composing the music for the CW's new take on Kung Fu, is a special assignment, a very special assignment, and she will detail why next half hour. Also ahead, Meekrat Manor rides again, Stars approves A Shining Veil, our new classic trivia winner, and we double-dip this takeaway of the week. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum, simulcasting live from New York on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker and Tuner Radio, and present on Amazon Music, Verbal, and the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. This just in, tomorrow will be televised. Brought to you by Audible.com, the leading provider of spoken audio entertainment information that will transform the way you hear the world. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book or two when you sign up for a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/televised. More details later in this program. Great to have you with us this Friday afternoon for the program about TV's current and future. A pair of great guests for you over the next hour or so, and we invite you to be interactive with our guests and with us. All you got to do is pick up the phone and dial in with this number, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. The number's good anyway. You're catching us across the country, around the globe, here on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, Tuner Radio. Shy about the phone? No problem. Use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name, and you will find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. If you use the phone or the room, either way, you're involved. And while the program is on the air, you can connect others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon, your Blog Talk speaker, tune in screen, follow the instructions, other people will be live with you. 50 degrees at the top of the hour here in the New York metro area, and Mark Bishop, from A Pair of Comedies, coming Monday night to BYU TV, who'll join us live from Toronto, Canada, after these news notes. Remember Meekrat Manor, Animal Planet's saga of the Whiskers, a family of meekrats that captured the fancy of viewers more than a decade ago? Well, those creatures of the Kalahari Desert in South Africa returned June 5th on BBC America. In this edition, subtitled Rise of the Dynasty, three meekrat families go through their daily quest for survival. The series will get an AMC Plus sneak preview May 29th. AMC Plus available on smart TV sets and smart TV devices. Stars pushed the green light on Shining Veil, the long-developed horror satire series co-starring Courtney Cox, Greg Kinnear, and Mira Savino. 8 episodes will be produced by a dysfunctional family and the spooky residence they occupy. Film is expected to begin over the next few weeks for a late 2021, early 22 debut on Stars. Now, quickies. Castlevania, one of Netflix's most popular anime toon series, will wrap its existence with Season 4, unveiled May 13th. A sequel series is under review. The next TV frontier may be due series and specials from outer space on a regular basis. No kidding. That's the objective of new production venture Space 11. Go ready, action, sans gravity. What will Season 1, oh, by the way, there's a possibility that first event that they may do is a sports event this summer. Again, the production company doing this in outer space, Space 11. What will Season 1 of Amazon's Lord of the Rings cost? Try $465 million. That's U.S. dollars, according to New Zealand's Economic Development Minister, Stuart Nash. Lord of the Rings expected to premiere next year on Amazon. Could NFT-owned, or should they derived character Aku, that's A-K-U, be a TV star? Anonymous Content thinks so, and the company's acquired media rights to and for TV and to Aku. That's right, media rights, that's TV and film, to Aku from artist Micah Johnson. He's also a former Major League Baseball player. And finally, here's our update on the crowdfunding project that we talked about on our last episode Tuesday afternoon. First of all, for all you Mystery Science Theater 3000 fans, you should know that as of an hour ago, MST3K raised $2,892,857. That's more than halfway to their goal for making new episodes. So far, they have the opportunity to make 4, maybe 5 episodes. And they still have 3 more weeks to go with their campaign on Kickstarter. And as for Clash TV, that's the interactive app and overlay that's now running on mixed martial arts programming on Fubo TV and other places, well, they've raised in their WeFunder.com campaign $476,659. And that is news notes for today. If you know your TV history, you know that in the first 2 decades of TV's existence, the 50s and the 60s, primetime did not start at 8 p.m. Eastern Time or Pacific. It started an hour earlier, 7 p.m. Eastern and Pacific Time. And a lot of our instant TV shows came out of that time period, Monday through Saturday nights. Then in the early 1970s, the Federal Communications Commission passed the primetime access rule, which said that rather than those that hour being programmed by ABC, CBS, NBC, it had to go back to their local stations, and they could program the hour which syndicated there. And it turned out by the end of the 1970s, it was mostly a game show haven for shows like Match Game, The Hollywood Squares, and The Price is Right. Well, we should point out, well, BYU-TV, this Brigham Young University television, that is the only national cable channel, satellite channel, owned by a college university, Brigham Young University, is bringing that days of early prime time back starting Monday night. From 7 to 8 p.m., they will program it with two original comedies. One is called The Parker Andersons, and the other is Amelia Parker, and they're boning back-to-back on that night. And joining us to talk about both of those projects, which are very, very related, is the executive producer behind both, joining us live from Toronto, Canada, Mark Bishop. Mark, welcome in.
Hi, very nice to be a part of this today. Thank you.
You're very, very welcome, Mark. How did this very unusual comedy project come about?
Well, it was interesting. When we first developed the idea for the Parker Andersons and Amelia Parker, I mean, our creator of the show really had this idea of, again, how do you create something that's going to be noisy and buzzy in a crowded space that we're all operating in, and finding different ways and different points of entry that audiences could come and find and get to know and love characters. And that's really what the idea was from the very beginning, is can you take one story and tell it and see it from two different perspectives, and see it from the family's perspective, and then be able to watch the second half or second chapter, if you will, you know, and see it from the young protagonist's perspective as well. And that was really the thinking behind it, that it could be, you know, unusual as an approach, can be noisy, and then hopefully, again, can provide opportunities for different points of engagement for audiences to come and find and fall in love with these characters.
And I understand that the creator is somebody that came from The Office, the TV show we're talking about.
Absolutely, yeah. So I was going to say, yes. The showrunner is a guy named Anthony Q. Farrell, and who actually is another proud Canadian like I am, but lived and worked in L.A. For a very long time, and worked on shows for NBC, like The Office, actually, for quite a while. You know, he was on The Thundermans for Nickelodeon, so did a lot of great, obviously, comedy content, kind of understands both the kids' world and the primetime world, and then just, again, we were lucky here in Canada because he has family and decided to move back, and we had the opportunity to work with him on this and really help, you know, craft and create this whole world. And he gets character, he gets story, and he gets comedy. And I think that's what you'll see in these characters.
So talk about the characters in the Parker Andersons. Then we'll get to Amelia. What kind of a family is this? What kind of environment do they exist in? And where does the comedy come from?
Absolutely. So at the heart of it, again, there are two families that have come together, as you can imagine from the name suggests, the Parkers and the Andersons, aptly named. So let's start with the Parker family. So Tony Parker, he is a big sports agent. He's British. And you know, he and his family, you know, have been living just outside of London. And unfortunately, again, prior to the series, you know, we learn and discover that his wife died in a car accident. And so, you know, again, one of the challenging things is that his daughter, Amelia, hence the name Amelia Parker, what happened to her after that is that she chose to become a selective mute. And it's important to the story because basically that for her was something that, obviously, it's traumatic losing your mom, and for her that was something that stuck with her and continues as she's been dealing with that. And as the family grows, and Tony, you know, happens to meet, you know, this lovely woman named Cleo Anderson, who is a well-known dentist in the Chicago area, and she and her family are in Chicago, and so of course the two fall in love, they meet, and they move in together, and that's really where our story starts. It's sort of just after that's happened. They're living in Chicago, Cleo Anderson and her family, and then Tony Parker and his family. And again, they're coming together in a real blended family, you know, again, from two different backgrounds, coming together, you know, a new life in this new house in Chicago that they've moved into, you know, and adapting, you know, to this world. And what's interesting, when I mentioned about the selective mute, Judaism that Amelia has, one of the interesting story beats that we did is that in the Parker Anderson series, she is a selective mute. She doesn't speak, right? And so she, you know, uses text messaging and using other tools to communicate with her and her friends. But when you watch the Amelia Parker series, you'll see the device that we use to be able to actually see her do direct-to-camera addresses through a video blog, where you hear her speak, you understand her thoughts, she gives you more backstory. So we use that as the central character, obviously, in both sides to see two different perspectives and have a real, you know, understanding of, obviously, what's going on in her head in the Parker Anderson series, how she's feeling. We actually hear her voice, and, you know, we empower her to be able to share and tell her stories on the Amelia Parker side of the series, and then get to watch this family, you know, getting to know each other and learning from each other and trying to adapt and do things differently, as they've come together, just, you know, so rooted in love. And then, you know, I will say, with all of that, then comedy ensues, right? Because, of course, as they're, you know, used to certain British customs, when you come to North America and come to Chicago, certain things, you know, don't exactly fly. So, you know, there's certain things that, you know, certain, you know, language they use about going to the chippy. Well, the chippy means something different. And so you've got a lot of, things that you would have expected from, you know, one side or the other, you know, all really rooted, obviously, in love and learning a different person's perspective. But it really brings a lot of, really natural comedy as you, you know, watch these people trying to get to know each other.
BYU TV, which over recent years has done some very unusual programs, both scripted and unscripted, may have its most unique project in the scripted category yet, premiering this Monday night, 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern time, and also 4 to 5 p.m. Pacific time. We're talking about two back-to-back comedies, The Parker Andersons and Amelia Parker, both made by the same production company, Marvel Media. The executive producer, Mark Fisher, is with us this half hour, live from Toronto, Canada, on Tomorrow Be Televised. Tom and Ab, I'm with you live from New York. Thanks for spending your Friday afternoon with us here on Blog Talk Radio, Squeaker Tuna Radio. If you have a question or comment for Mark, don't be shy. Use those fingers and dial in, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Earlier this week, American Documentary, the company behind the award-winning PBS independent documentary series POV, Point of View, hired a new executive director. Her name is Erica Dilde. You will meet her Monday, exclusively on Tawabi Television. Erica Dilde from American Documentary and POV, which, of course, is around for years on public television. She'll be with us live as our lead guest. Erica Dilde here Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern Pacific on Tawabi Television. Was the game plan all along, Mark, to do both shows simultaneously rather than start with the Parker Andersons, see how that goes, and then spin off Amelia Parker?
No, that's a really great question, actually. No one's ever asked me that before. So thank you, quite sincerely. The game plan was always to do both at the exact same time. And I think it's really important, just as we kind of think about how we tell this story, from two different perspectives. The idea was always to, you know, be able to, look at both, you know, the environments where we're shooting, the narrative that we're telling. I think it's helpful for the actors as well. I mean, the scripts are different, obviously, and the types of things that we cover in each are different. But there's a lot of overlap between what happens, obviously, because it's a regular family sitcom, both at home, in terms of seeing the comedy, but at school as well too. So there's a lot of overlap, and it was written so carefully. I mean, what Anthony and his writers did in terms of kind of writing it in a way that it lets us lead into certain things, just touch on, say, in the Parker Anderson episode. So you have to go and watch the Amelia Parker episode to kind of understand, why did you cut to that scene where the two kids are walking down the street having this conversation? There's clearly more to it than I realize. So stay tuned and watch the Amelia Parker episode, and you'll find out what that is. They are designed so that if you do only happen to catch one, you'll get a great, satisfying experience, or if you discover it online, because you can stream it online, of course, at BYU TV. You may find one first, and that's great. Again, I get back to from a discoverability perspective. Like, we're all looking for ways of how do we get audiences to engage, find our shows, and fall in love with our characters. So inherently in the storytelling, that's a big part of it. It's just really finding different narratives that can exist independently. But then there is a real reward for the viewer, again, who invests that time and stays with us for the full hour, and that they they will see the payoff, and they will see the nuances that we seeded in one show and watch them pay off in the other. And there are lots of laughs. There are definitely some nice sentimental moments as well, too. Like, it's a great roller coaster of a journey the audiences will go on. And like I said, that there's a real, we often say it's the prize for careful viewing, where if you watch it and kind of wonder, like, wait a second, what's that teasing up? You know, stay tuned. You'll find out in just a few minutes.
With the fact you're doing two shows at once, what kind of coordination was there with the writing teams, the production teams, the directors, the cast, in terms of making sure each show knew what the other was doing?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, again, what's nice about the writing team, again, led by Anthony and his writers, all the shows were written, together, right? So that, again, there's a lot of thinking that goes on in terms of, what should happen in the Parker Anderson episode versus what happens in an Amelia Parker episode. So a lot of that work and the writing happened, while that was going on. And so really looking at how do you tie all of that in. You know, there's a lot of work that has to happen, as you can appreciate, from a production standpoint, because these shows, everyone knows, they take a while to shoot. We shoot both in studio, and we do a lot of location shooting as well, too, and then you're really dealing with weather, and you have to be a little bit sensitive about the fact of acknowledging that if you're doing the Parker Anderson, it's meant to take place, and that scene is meant to take place in the, in the middle of the day where it's bright and sunny. Well, if we shoot the Amelia Parker end of that scene 2 days later and it happens to be cloudy, or we were shooting last fall in Toronto, and, just like I know lots of parts of the U.S., we had an early winter at certain times, so trying to hide the snow and try and get some leaves back on the trees, and because they had leaves 20 minutes earlier in the other series, you have some legitimate production concerns for continuity. So I give full props to our both our props department, but our continuity department, to really look at that and really make sure that there was consistency between what we did in the Amelia Parker and in the Parker Anderson. And there'll be some awards for careful viewing of people who notice if there are some continuity gaps, but we worked really hard to try and not have that happen, and really make sure that we had consistency between the two series.
And what about how you have to do things like cinematography or film editing or tape editing, the post-production side of things, so that while each show works with the other, each show also has an individual identity?
Absolutely. And I think that's a really important point, right, is to making sure, from the very beginning, our goal, Anthony's goal and our whole team's goal, was to make sure each chapter could stand on its own. So that, like I said, audiences may happen to discover, a Parker Anderson episode or an Amelia Parker episode, and we want, when audiences come, and you may only have half an hour, right? Like, not all of us, I have a young daughter at home, I don't always have enough time to watch as much TV as I would like to, and so you may have to watch one night and one the other. So we're being respectful of that. We want to make sure that each, episode is satisfying, right? And so we really want to make sure that is the case, and so that was really important to us to make sure we could go and achieve that and make sure that works. But then, of course, as you say, you get into the post-production process and just making sure that, we had different techniques. So, as you'll see in Amelia Parker, for example, like I was saying, she does these on-camera addresses directly to her blog. Some of those are voiceover as well, so that gave us another technique and tool that we could use in terms of being able to tell the story, get things across, but that's not something we do in the Parker Anderson side. There's no voiceover on that side. There's no direct to camera. And of course, Amelia doesn't speak. So imagine the challenge that you have both from a writing and an execution standpoint that, in the Amelia Parker part of the series, she can, again, talk to camera and she can have voiceover. In the Parker Anderson side of the series, she doesn't speak at all as a selective mute. So we have to work and make sure, we find different devices for, how those story beats get communicated. She's obviously an integral role in the Parker Anderson's family. So, there were things like that we had to work on both during production and as well during post-production. And we do, part of our editing process is actually we use the same, we have a team of editors, as you can appreciate, that works on a show. But we make sure it's the same editor who's editing the Parker Anderson and who's editing the Amelia Parker, because again, they have that understanding, the consistency. They get the fact that there, like I said, there are certain things that we can, the rules we can do, in a Parker Anderson's, for example, versus an Amelia Parker, and how much of the story we want to tell in each one. We have incredible editors, as well as our directors who had the vision for it to execute it, the editors who then have to go in and actually bring it together. But they can look at both of the shows and make sure that there's a real richness to the story and that there's a nice symmetry between both perspectives.
Who plays Amelia Parker, and what kind of challenge was it for her to play really a silent soul in one series and then let it out in video blogging in the other?
Yeah, good question. So the young woman who plays Amelia Parker, her name is Millie Davis. And Millie, you know, for anybody that has young kids, and you know, you would have seen her in the hit PBS series Odd Squad, which is also produced here in Toronto, not by our company, by another Toronto-based company, Sinking Ship Entertainment. And Millie is just, again, a stellar young actress. She was just nominated for an award earlier this week here in Canada, you know, for her work, you know, on another series. And she's done just a phenomenal job, you know, on our show, of course, but on so many others, you know, because she brings, you know, just so much warmth and heart to the characters who she plays, right? And I think, you know, again, I know she did a lot of research, and we you know, helped her in terms of, you know, consultation of selective mutism, right, and what that is, and, you know, working with therapists around, you know, trauma, and which we talk about on the show, and actually there is, a therapy session as well, which she does on the show, because obviously we want to promote and model that and talking about your feelings and all of those things. So we see what she's going through, but we, behind the scenes, made sure, you know, she was able to kind of, you know, understand that world and understand the character that she's playing. And then I think I'll say it's, you know, sometimes challenging on the Parker Anderson side, where she doesn't speak at all, because again, she's obviously got a great voice and she's hilarious. So there'll be moments where, you know, she actually says something by accident. We have to cut the take because, wait a minute, you can't, your character doesn't speak in this. This is Parker Anderson, not Amelia Parker, right? So you have moments like that because she's just, you know, having fun on set. And she really does. But what you see, and I can't wait for people to see with Parker Anderson, is that she really brings so much warmth and love on screen, in many cases without speaking, right? So it's, you know, again, she emotes. I mean, so much of it obviously is with her eyes. You know, and then just with her body language, you know, again, she has friends, she goes to a sleepover, she, you know, does after school program, she plays sports, she plays soccer, all these things in the show, you know, and all of these things that she's able to do and kind of bring the Amelia Parker character to life. You know, and like I said, it's a big role, and it is really challenging on that Parker Anderson side. And then on the Amelia Parker side, I mean, again, she's a star. She just brings so much energy and emotion, you know, and richness to the character. You know, and some of these are really heartfelt moments. Like, I mean, I talk about this sort of roller coaster of emotions that you see in the series. You get a lot of comedy, but then you get moments where she's writing this video blog is to her mom, and she's sharing all of these, you know, just deeply personal feelings and kind of processing how she's feeling. So you get the really emotional, heartfelt moments, you know, at the same time as, you know, then just going and having fun and being silly with her friends. So I think she is a rising star. I know she's, you know, going to be doing some other series with other people, and I think you'll continue to see her rise, you know, on numerous other productions.
Mm-hmm. If you have a question or comment, our remaining minutes with Mark Bishop from the BYU New Comedy, the premiere Monday night, and that is the Parker Anderson's Amelia Parker. Make the call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, Simon Apple 041. Mark, what do you think about the scheduling by BYU of doing this in what used to be early prime time, early in TV's existence, where the shows are on 7 to 8 p.m. Eastern, as opposed to 8 or 9, which we now see as like the family hour for a lot of primetime comedies?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think, I mean, again, I applaud them for placing the shows in that slot, because I think I think of my own family, you know, and that time slot, the 7 to 8 p.m. time slot, is really the time where, you know, families come together and, you know, have normally just finished dinner, you know, or maybe they're, you know, just having dessert, you know, and it's an opportunity. I just know in our house, you know, before kids go to bed, and that you look for a bit of light entertainment that you can watch together, right? And I think what's so great about what BYU is doing, obviously, is in terms of, you know, their mission to bring families together and have content experiences they can watch together. I think that's what's you know, what is so unique about our show is that it really does that. And then we've created something, like I said, that gives multiple points of entry that, you know, we want kids to watch. We want the 8 and 9-year-olds to kind of watch the show and then tell their friends about it, but then, you know, tell their parents about it, right? If the parents, you know, go and discover it first, which they might, you know, and then they say, you know what, tomorrow night we should go check out this episode because I saw this show and I think we could all watch it together. I mean, to me, that is true co-viewing, is that you could have different ways that people come about finding the show. But I think the time slot is really important, right? And because I think, you know, if it was too much later in the evening, you know, there may be an expectation of, you know, different storylines. It's less about kids and perhaps more about older teens and adults. You know, I think a show, you know, what we were always designing for is something that, you know, again, has obviously really strong kid characters with Amelia and, you know, her family, but also has strong, you know, parent characters and watch, being able to watch, again, the opportunities, the challenges, the struggles that parents go through, you know, bringing up kids, bringing a blended family together and, you know, dealing with all kinds of issues, you know, but, you know, still loving each other and having lots of fun. And I think we can, you know, our show does that with such heart that I'm, you know, I love, like I said, where this time slot is, because it, you know, it brings together, you know, both chapters of this show in a nice hour-long place that, you know, again, I hope people have a chance to kind of sit down and check it out. And I also say, like, you know, the funny thing about, to me now about time slots is also, well, you know, so much of this is on demand, right? So it's like that, to me, a time slot is great for discoverability. It's great for the first time you happen to turn it on. If you are looking for something at 7 o'clock at night, we're there, right? But then hopefully after that, then you say, well, I want to watch more episodes. Let's go online, right? And I know that's how it works in our house, right? And so my hope is then after that, by being able to watch it, you know, on their app, or on their website, then to be able to go and watch more episodes and discover it, you know, at your own time, because your family time is probably different from my family time, and maybe you want to do it on Saturday afternoon and what have you. You know, obviously the technology can allow all of that stuff to happen, but I think from an initial discoverability, and that's what we're all trying to do, we're trying to make great shows that break through and that audiences can find. We're all busy people. There's loads of great content that's out there, and there's not enough hours in a day to eat and sleep and watch the great stuff that we want to watch. So, you know, our hope is that by having something that's really unique and special, you know, at the right time slot with a lot of great promotion and, again, opportunities like this to have great conversations and share with people, the hope is that people will discover it. You know, we'll check it out, give it a chance, and then you can come back and watch it at 7. You can watch it online. You can watch it on Saturday afternoon. You can watch it whenever you like. But, you know, it's designed for families to be able to watch together.
Well, we have about a minute left. I understand there's other things coming up at Marvel Media, including another show from your friend from The Office.
Yeah, absolutely. We have another new series that we're just about to go into production on right now, called Overlord and the Underwoods, which is really exciting. So that's a new family comedy. And then we also, you know, on the other side of our business, have a number of really interesting unscripted series. We have one on Netflix about glass blowing called Blown Away. Again, who knew? But it's such an interesting world. So, you know, we obviously, as you can tell, have a lot of fun at Marvel Media, you know, finding interesting characters, exploring interesting worlds, and bringing people together to have fun.
Incidentally, we did an interview with the executive producer of Blown Away on this program earlier this year. If you want to catch that, go to our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. And if you want to catch the opening episodes next week of The Parker Andersons and Amelia Parker, go to BYU TV. That is the National Television Network from Brigham Young University, the only one by a college university in the United States. And it's on a special time, Monday from 7 to 8 p.m. Eastern, 4 to 5 p.m. Pacific. It's 7 to 8 p.m. Eastern, 4 to 5 p.m. Pacific, this Monday night. Check your locals where BYU TV is available in your area on cable and satellite. For more details about the programs online, go to BYUTV.org. That's BYUTV.org. Mark Bishop, the executive producer of The Parker Andersons, Amelia Parker. Good luck with the show starting on Monday night, hopefully the beginning of a very long run. And congratulations on all the great work you're doing at Marvel Media up in Canada.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for this opportunity, and always enjoy having our conversation. So thank you, and have a great weekend.
You're very welcome, Mark. You too. All the greatest. Take care. Mark Bishop, executive producer of the Parker Anderson and Amelia Parker, coming to BYU TV this Monday, early prime time. When we come back, the next voice you hear will be one of the fastest rising composers in music television. Her name is Sherry Chung. Her latest work, Kung Fu, the acclaimed new remake of the iconic series 1970s with an Asian American cast, Wednesday night on the CW. She'll join us live from Los Angeles after we pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. You're connected to the best internet radio on the planet, www.blogtalkradio.com, speaker.com, and tuner.com. Together reaching nearly 60 million listeners around the world every month and growing. Don't forget tomorrow, 9 a.m. Eastern Time, it's Fastlane Sports Show. Get your sneak preview of what's going on in the world of sports, from Major League Baseball to NBA regular season, and much, much more. The Fastlane Sports Show, tomorrow, 9 a.m. Eastern Time, 6 a.m. Pacific, only on Blog Talk Radio. And remember, best to BTR 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back tomorrow to Mavi Televised on this Friday afternoon, 16th of April, 2021. Simon Applebaum with you live from New York. Delighted to have you with us. 50 degrees at the top of the hour in the Big Apple metro area. Great guests coming your way in the half hour ahead. And we invite you, of course, to be part of the program if you're just joining us. So give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04. And coming up later this half hour, we will give you our newest classic trivia winner and what that trivia winner will get in terms of a trio of great prizes. My next guest is a fast-rising, and I do mean fast-rising composer in the world of making episodic TV music happen. Her previous work includes the long-running series Blind Spot on NBC, and she's also a composer on the CW with Riverdale. And her latest work, you can find Wednesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time on the CW. It's the critically acclaimed remake, or some would call updating, of the iconic 1970 series Kung Fu. Joining us live from Los Angeles, an interradio exclusive, Sherry Chung. Well, Sherry, great to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Simon. It's great to be here.
It's a pleasure. John Burlingame, Variety's Mr. TV Music and the author of a fantastic book that everyone should read called TV's Greatest Hits, did an interview with you that was published earlier this week and noted that you see Kung Fu as more than just a writing music assignment. You see it as a rediscovery. What are you rediscovering?
You know, it's interesting because I am half Chinese. My father, you know, has that sort of very common immigrant story where his parents came from China. And when they got here, it's, you know, as many immigrant stories go, you know, there's this assimilation to be American and take advantage of the opportunities. And I feel like a lot of times when that happens, one's culture, where they came from, what they're bringing with them, gets a bit muted, you know. And so I think that it's sort of how that's translated to my upbringing is that I didn't grow up with the same kind of, you know, celebration of my own heritage. I lost my grandparents when I was a bit younger, so I didn't really get a chance to, you know, really engage them in conversation and ask them about where they really came from. And what's interesting about working on Kung Fu is that as I watch some of these scenes about, like, the parents who come from China and have made a family here and a life for themselves here in the United States, I watch the conversations that some of them they have, and I wonder, gosh, you know, I wonder if maybe my grandparents had those same conversations. You know, and it's just really interesting to sort of connect with the show in that way. There's a lot of legend and, you know, mystical parts about it, but there's a lot of, you know, emphasis on what it means to be an immigrant, specifically a Chinese immigrant in this country. And it's sort of allowing me to connect with a past that I didn't know much about and a culture that had become a bit muted over the years.
Mm-hmm. When you see episode after episode being produced and you see how this drama has taken a family turn, and you really see that going from episode to episode, how does that influence how you score individual scenes, how you score the action adventure, how you score the family moments?
Yeah, it's a lot of, I mean, episodic, you know, works in that way where it's, you know, unlike film, you can't see the end, right? You don't know exactly how these characters develop. You don't really know what happens to them. You know, obviously creative conversations with producers and showrunners and writers can help you see sort of an arc to the season. But that's not always going to, you know, be the case. Changes are made all the time. And as actors really grow into their own characters and change things, I feel like the music does as well. Not only as the writing develops for the characters, but also, you know, as like I said, the actors develop their own their own voice and their own development and evolution of those characters, just in how they portray them and how they invest in themselves and invest themselves in those characters. I think the music really does that too. So it's as that drama sort of unfolds, their themes develop. I try to use new instrumentation. I try to use these themes in maybe a more emotional way if it calls for it, or something that's, you know, a bit more, you know, just it matches the drama in that way. So sometimes their themes or their, you know, get elongated. Sometimes you hear them faster, and sometimes you just hear sort of shortened variations of them.
We had Christina Kim, the executive producer, the showrunner, and the writer of the first episode, co-writer of the second, on this program a week ago Monday. And it was very clear that she had a mandate, which was, I'm going to make this show as much Asian American as possible. The cast, my co-producer is Asian American, my writing team has Asian Americans, the production team, including yourself, is Asian American with that. What guidance did she give you when it came to putting the score together?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because she and I had lengthy conversations, several conversations that we revisited, and then both of us sort of revised what we were saying, or, you know, evolved as it were. But we did have conversations about, you know, what is the function of score? You know, what's the role of a score? And that's something I always think about when I start a project, and certainly as I'm involved in a project, is what is the function of the score? Because sometimes score, you know, needs to set a time and a place. And other times songs do that. And that's something that, you know, that's not, you know, original music that's being scored to the show. Those are pre-existing songs, or, you know, with lyrics oftentimes that are often, you know, helpful in setting a tone or a genre or a time period or a decade or something like that. So in this case, we really felt the score had several different functions. When we were dealing with dramatic parts of the episodes that didn't really have to do anything with Chinese culture or Asian American culture, you know, we really felt that the music should not be Asian or Chinese or influenced in that way. And then of course, on the opposite side, when things are really dealing with the cultural specificity of maybe what it means to be a Chinese American or Asian American, you know, that was a time to lean more into the Asian influence. And then certainly, and that's sort of like a medium, if you will, sort of like a level 5 on a scale of 1 to 10. And then a 10, which is something that I would consider strongly leaning into Asian music or Chinese music, or sort of influenced by that, is when we deal with, you know, flashbacks with the murdered teacher, the murdered Shufu, Pei Ling, as well as legendary things having to do with the weapon, sword, any of those things that have to do with that sort of ancient Chinese culture and mythology. So you know, again, I think the score is really important in setting that vibe and that tone for when we're talking about, you know, things that are really Asian influence and Chinese influence. So it does vary. It goes Chinese, it goes American, and sometimes it's sort of an amalgam of both.
Mm-hmm. Kung Fu Version 2021, produced by Warner Brothers, by the way, is now on the CW Wednesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern and Pacific Time, and getting rave reviews, by the way, including like 88-90% critical reviews from Rotten Tomatoes on their website. And we've got the composer of the program, Sherry Chung, with us live from Los Angeles this half hour. On Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Tom Abba, I'm with you live from New York. Happy you're born this Friday afternoon. Be involved with the program. Give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Sherry, the original series back in the 1970s had a brilliant score by a man named Jim Helms, who was a guitarist who worked with the composer Ron McEwen. If you read TV's Greatest Hits, you know that Alex Beaton, who was originally an associate producer on the show, then became producer, said that Helms was somebody who was out of the mainstream. And his score really reflected that. Even though it was set in the West in part, there was a great variety with the score. It was very offbeat, very unusual, used a lot of Asian musical instruments, a harpsichord when Kane, played by David Carradine, was walking, you know, into a Western town to sort of get the Americana side of things. Did you have a chance to hear the score before you set off on your own with your score?
I did. I had heard a little bit of the score back, literally when I was growing up, and sort of a little bit watching the show. Just, you know, my parents watched it here and there, and so I did hear a little bit of it. But I purposely didn't want to dive into what had been done before, beyond what I had already sort of known. So I didn't really want to be influenced by past choices and decisions by the show and the composer. I really wanted to kind of blaze a new trail.
Mm-hmm. And incidentally, if you've never, for those of you who have never heard Jim Helms' the score, do hear it. It's a classic. And why he never got an Emmy Award nomination for it, I don't understand. One of those musical situations, Sherry, that has happened with a lot of the Emmy Award nominees in music in the 1970s and 80s. Quite a few great scores, like Stuart Copeland's work on The Equalizer, Miami Vice's score by Jan Hammer, all extraordinary scores, groundbreaking, never got Emmy nominated or didn't win, which, crazy time at the time.
You know,
much
I mean,
better now,
you know,
I think.
But I mean, you're literally describing like every award season for you know, since the history and in the future. It's in many ways the, you know, there's so many great scores that never necessarily get recognized in any shape or form in terms of awards. But I do think that the awards sort of reflect sometimes just sort of what happens to be popular, what people sort of, you know, resonating with, and oftentimes great scores that are attached to great shows. You know, do get overlooked, but I think it's just more of just awards are kind of nebulous in that way, and certainly, as you just mentioned, you know, are not really a reflection of the great work that is really out there. But it is a shame that so many great scores get snubbed in that way.
But going back to your score, one thing I notice is that going back to the family scenes, you sometimes get very playful, very offbeat. It's like this sort of very interesting things going on in this household, whether it's by Nikki, played by Olivia Dang, or her sister, played by Zha Dong, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot, sometimes it's very serious, but sometimes it's also, I get a very playful sense from your work.
Yeah, I do love it. I do love the whimsical, the comical. So that's why one of the reasons I really appreciate the show, because it really allows for all of that. It allows the entire emotional landscape to be, you know, to be seen on as well as heard in the music. And yes, a lot of those family scenes really were trying to capture the playfulness of the family, the love of the family. And I think that, you know, a great family has all of it. It has the drama, but it also has the fun and the lightness to it. And that's something that I appreciate about the writing of the show, but also the way that the characters portray it. So the music, I do try to, you know, add that levity in there and add that sort of silliness. I mean, I think in episode 2 in particular, it was, so I know that one just aired, you know, it does start out with that sort of, you know, sort of odd family meal where it, like, everything is now perfect. What's going on? And so part of the fun was to play that up and almost how ridiculously happy the family was, you know, was to kind of play that up.
Mm-hmm. And flipping it to the action scenes, am I hearing right that we hear you?
In some of the action scenes in the pilot, as well as the second episode, which is, I don't think any others have aired at this point, but in some of the action scenes, there are songs. Like, some of them are songs. They've you know, licensed them for a lot of that, you know, dramatic effectiveness. But as we get later into things, and I think in these episodes too, I'm definitely scoring some of the fight scenes. So some of them are songs, some of them are score, depending on which one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What is your scoring style like? Do you wait for an episode to come your way in its entirety, and then you score? Or do you go scene by scene or set of scenes and figure, okay, for this segment, here's where I want to be, for this segment, then this segment, and so on and so forth? What's your modus operandi in terms of scoring the show?
Yes, so for scoring, I do see the entire episode. It's very important for me to see it all the way through, because I want to know where things start, where the peak of things are, where they end, and it gives me a really good sense of sort of the approach for that week. Are we leaning more on the emotional? Do we need to lean more into sort of Asian influenced music? Do we need to lean more into the action, you know, and pull out those big drums and that kind of thing? So I don't score scene to scene, because to me it's not because it's all very connected. You know, everything is connected. What happens in the beginning is connected in the end. You know, and you can see that when you watch an entire show down. So the music has to be like that too, because it's, you know, so that there's handoff, literally like logistical handoff between this, the music of this scene into the music of that scene. So it's sort of a seamless transition. That's more of a logistical thing. But also in terms of callbacks, you know, some of these episodes really require a new theme or a new motive, or, you know, some motivic material that gets progressed as the show goes. So if I don't, or as the episode goes, if I can't see the full episode, I don't know how to, you know, have that music expand and contract as the show needs.
Mm-hmm. At any point, do you get the chance, either through Christina or through direct contact with the actors or the writers, to get the essence of characters? You know, this is like Nikki's backstory. This is her sister's backstory, or her essence. This is her, Nikki's mentor's essence at that temple. This is the guest star character's essence that we're going to deal with that particular, or storyline we're going to deal with that week.
Yes, yeah, and that's really important on all the shows that I work on, just to have those, you know, creative conversations with the showrunners. So that it's important, especially on the show too, it's just really, really important, you know, and Christina will say, oh yes, we're going into the backstory of these characters. And so, you know, oftentimes, and sometimes I have even talked to the directors of some of the episodes as well, where they chime in about, like, here's what I was thinking when I was shooting this, or when we were putting this together. We really want to feel, I think in episode 6, this actually happens, and I won't give anything away, but, you know, it's the idea was, you know, the group is doing this thing, and so we really need a sound for this to really tie it together and create that momentum and that connective, musical connective tissue, as well as dramatic, you know, dramatically as well. So we have those conversations to you know, it's good for me to know what's coming up, because sometimes you have to lay the groundwork early. Sometimes if you know, when you know what something is happening in a later episode, but you see a little bit of foreshadowing in an earlier episode that again, no one will really know about until they see the later one. It's really good to sometimes really important to lay down that sort of lay that type, if you will, musically.
By the way, when you use the Asian musical instruments, what I've heard in performance, like the arpu or percussion, do you bring in other musicians to do it, or do you do it on synthesizer? How do you bring those sounds to life?
So it started, bringing those sounds, it's a combination. It's a combination of synthesized instruments, or what we call in the box, as it were, so from generated from the computer and sample instruments, a combination of three things: that, as well as I recorded specifically Chinese drums before I even did the pilot. I actually brought in a number of Chinese drums onto a recording stage, and then had them played, had them performed in different variations, whether it be single, you know, hits or not loops, but sort of grooves, if you will, and sort of ensembles. And then I take those, so that those are all recorded, and I've made essentially a sample library, or essentially a virtual instrument from those live samples. And I use that in the score, and I can play them and I can manipulate them. I time stretch them. I create new patterns and new rhythms. So that's all something. And then the third thing that I do is I do actually bring in live players for the show. I not every player is not every instrument can be covered live. Like some of them are just synthesized sounds, but there's, you know, there is an air who players. She's wonderful. I work with her, and she comes in with the chord. I also work with strings soloistically, sometimes a slightly larger group as well. So it's definitely a combination of the live elements, you know, in real time, as it were, you know, being recorded for each episode, as well as instruments that were recorded months and months ago, like almost a year ago now, actually. And then those are put in there, as well as synthesized and you know, computer sounds, if you will.
Yeah. I noticed in the episode on Wednesday you had the scene where Nikki is in a park and she's doing Tai Chi Falun Gong exercises, where she then sees the character she's going to help bring to justice later. But the thing is that there was a lot of flute, for example, the very, like,
yes.
Soup. So I was wondering if that was also either synthesized or that was a live player.
So a combination of both. It's like, you know, sampled players from before that I then use and again manipulate their sound. But bamboo flutes and Chinese flutes and those types of things. So it's sort of a combination of, again, previously recorded and sampled and then manipulated after in the computer.
Sherry, how did you break into doing episodic TV?
Yeah, I started out, I did get formal training. I did, you know, undergraduate and graduate work in school. And then right when I graduated school, I did my graduate work at University of Southern California. I became an assistant to a composer. His name was Walter Murphy, and he writes the music for Family Guy and American Dad, and I became his assistant. And that was kind of my first step into the episodic world, watching the pace of things, watching live players. And of course, you know, if you know the music of Family Guy and American Dad, it's actually quite involved, and it's very intricate, and it's just very, very well done. And that was kind of my first taste in seeing that world. And then about 5 or 6 years after that, I started doing additional writing for a composer named Blake Neely, who does a lot of episodic television, not just superhero shows, but I think that's some of his more well-known work just on the CW is superhero show. So I started doing additional writing with him. And then from there, he and I became more equal parts collaborators and partners. And then I just started, you know, branching out from there. But before all that, I'd actually done film. It was really hard to break into episodic on a sort of indie level, if you will. Like, there really isn't any indie TV, I don't think, you know. And that was also when I started, was long before Netflix was, you know, producing and being creators of content. Before, they were just, you know, the mailing system where you have your DVDs and you kind of mail them back and forth. So it was really before streaming and the amount of episodic content that's out there. So I actually started in film, and then, you know, as I really started working on in my career and it started to turn, it actually turned more into episodic. So while I do both, I think more prominently right at the moment, it's leaned a lot more into episodic. There's just so much content right now.
Who are some of your role models, your the people that, you know, you see as like Hall of Fame for you in the genre that you get inspired by or you listen to that really turn you on as a composer?
Yeah, you know, one of them really is like my long-term collaborator and before mentor, which would be Blake Neely. I so greatly value the music that he, you know, the standards and the high quality of caliber of writing that he puts on television, not just the shows that he and I have worked on together, but shows that he's done many shows on his own. And, you know, and I really value, you know, having a living composer that I can even ask questions to. So I really value that. There's also, I guess, less episodic, I guess, because I'm not sure if he doesn't have any episodic, but Alexander Splott is one of my great role models, I think, just, you know, compositionally, and he does, you know, mainly film. But there's always the greats, you know, the Danny Elfman and Thomas Newman are people that composers that I greatly look up to. I really love their music. Gosh, there's so many really great composers out there, both in episodic and film. But yeah, those are some of my most beloved composers. You know, I love their work so much.
I love Thomas Newman. I think the man is brilliant. And one of these days, he's going to win that Oscar. He should have had
right?
it a long
that
time ago for films like American Beauty and Shawshank Redemption. Yeah. And he did win the Emmy for 6 Feet Under, his wonderful theme for that show, with a great title sequence,
yeah.
too.
Perfect example.
One of the best.
Yeah, perfect example of how awards don't necessarily, you know, honor the ones who should be honored the most. It's a great example of that.
And he's done
go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Sorry.
I was saying that Newman has been honored for both great work in both live action and animated movies. His work on Finding Nemo, for example.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was just saying earlier that you know, he's such an acclaimed composer and writer. He's done so much great work, but as you mentioned earlier, like, has not won an Oscar, which is absolutely crazy to me. So it's just kind of one of those, I guess, one of those crazy examples of how awards often snub those who are very deserving, but he's certainly deserving.
Speaking of animation, and you mentioned that before because of your work on Family Guy, you're doing a score for an upcoming animated series on HBO Max, the spinoff of the popular movie Gremlins.
Yes, Gremlins, Secrets of the Mogwai. So this is a 10-episode series, and it is meant to be a prequel to the films, the 1989, and I forget when the second one came out, I think, but yeah, it's meant to be a prequel for those. And I don't know when the air date is. I'm not sure when that's all coming together, but it's very exciting. And I think it's not just for kids. It's definitely for the nostalgic adults. It's animated, but they're definitely going for an older audience as well. Suitable for kids, but also an older audience. It's really terrific with a great cast, and the animation looks terrific, and the showrunners and producers are just amazing people and amazing artists and professionals. I'm very fortunate to get to work on this project.
Yeah, the understanding from HBO Max is that it will probably be this summer or this fall. Have you already thought about your scenario for the kind of music you want to do?
Oh yes, we're well into that part of it, and it's gonna. I won't give anything away yet. I don't really know what I can talk about, but I will say it's very exciting. Both it's very creatively fulfilling for me. I will say this, and I think that audiences really enjoy both what they're seeing, what the story is, and hopefully what they're hearing in the music.
And if you haven't heard what Sherry is up to on Kung Fu, you get your third opportunity this coming Wednesday night, 8:10 Pacific time on the CW, as Kung Fu continues to get rave reviews, great cast, great music, wonderful production all around, and it really is a breakthrough for the Asian American production community at long, long last. And I can tell you this, the CW executives, very, very happy with both the critical and the audience reaction to it. Again, check out Kung Fu, 8 p.m. Eastern Pacific time on the CW. Check your locals for the CW station airing, including WPX-TV here in New York. For more details about the program online, CWTV.com at CWTV.com. You also check out Sherry's work on Riverdale, also on the CW, and then later this year on HBO Max with the new Gremlins animated series. Sherry, it's been a pleasure all the way to have you with us. Congratulations on your work with Kung Fu. Congratulations to Christina and everybody in the cast and crew for what you're doing. By the way, if you want to hear the episode we did with Christina, check it out at blogtalkradio.com/televised. Sherry, again, a pleasure. All the greatest to you going forward.
Thank you so much, Simon. I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
You're very, very welcome. Take care. Have a sensational weekend.
Thank you. You as well.
Sherry Chung from Kung Fu joining us live from Los Angeles. One more time, check out episode 3 on the CW this coming Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern and Pacific time. And now it's time for our classic trivia question of the week. And for the first time in a number of weeks, we have a winner. And that winner is Jim Forkin from Bayside, New York. And Jim's got a trio of prizes coming his way. The new Richard Liu book from MSNBC's anchor person called Enough About Me. Plus, the Star Wars, speaking of great soundtracks, the Star Wars, Episode 1, The Phantom Menace soundtrack by the Oscar and Emmy-winning composer John Williams, and Wycliffe Jean, Carnival Volume 2, Memoirs of an Immigrant. The question we posed for the last week and a half, name the actors playing the first pair of policemen on the first season of Law & Order. The answer, Chris Noth, who was on the series for the first 4 seasons, then came back in a made-for-TV movie Exile episode, and then years later was one of the co-stars of Law & Order Criminal Intent. The other was George Dunza, D-Z-U-N-D-Z-A, I believe, and he was on the first season, and he was also the first Law & Order main character to be killed off at the beginning of the second season. In case you don't know George Dunza by name, you know his face if you saw the movie No Way Out. He played the wheelchair employee at the company that Kevin Costner's character was involved with. So, and a wonderful actor, too, by the way, in a lot of different roles, both in movies and television. So once again, the answer, it was George Dunza and Chris Noth, who played the original pair of policemen on the first season of Law and Order. So congratulations again to Jim Forkin of Bayside, New York. Your prizes are on the way to you, and we will have a new classic trivia question on our episode Monday. If you know the answer when you hear it, email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. It's simonapple04@yahoo.com. Remember, when you email the answer, don't forget to include your name and where you're mailing from, so if you win, we get the prize out to you ASAP. And if we don't get a winner by the end of the Monday, we'll post the question Tuesday morning on social media, on Facebook at Simon Applebaum, and on Twitter at UBC Simon TWBT. That's UBC Simon TWBT. Remember, in order to win, you got to play in, and all the very best. And now some words from the fine folks at our sponsor, Audible.com. 9/11, the Twain anniversary is coming up in September. And in advance of that, there's a very interesting new audiobook called The Devil's Hand by Jack Carr. It is about a 9/11 situation of a very mysterious kind, including a new president of the United States. How has he solved this dilemma? Well, that's what The Devil's Hand is all about. And that could be an audiobook you listen to for a month through a one-month trial of Audible.com. You know, Audible.com is the leading provider of spoken digital entertainment, information, and inspiration. Over 200,000 titles to choose from. And you can listen to them on any device, including whatever you are hearing us on right now at Blog Talk Radio, Speaker Tuner Radio, iHeartRadio, Verbal, Amazon Music, etc. Just sign up at audibletrial.com/televised. audibletrial.com/televised. You get one free audiobook, one-month trial, health and wellness information for a limited time only, and great customer service from Audible's parent, Amazon.com. Oh, and by the way, if you are an Amazon Prime member already, it's two audiobooks you get for your trial of one. One of those books could be from the growing, fast-growing catalog, I might add, of Audible Originals. We're talking original audio productions and podcasts, best of Broadway, off-Broadway, regional theater, and great one woman and one man performances. So how about making today or this weekend the opportunity for you or someone you love to discover how Audible.com can transform the way you hear the world. And all it takes is to go to audibletrial.com/televised. When we come back, our takeaway, should they takeaways, plural, of the week. But right now, let's pause at the top of the hour for web identification. This is www.blogtalkradio.com, speaker.com, and tune.com. You're over the best internet radio on the planet, reaching nearly 60 million listeners around the world every month and growing. Don't forget, this Monday night, it's Mixing It with Nikki Chris. That's Mixing It with Ricky Chris. Check it out, 6 p.m. Eastern. I should say not 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. It's 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Mixing It with Nikki Chris. Terrific musical talent for you right here on Blog Talk Radio. And remember, best BTR happening 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to our final section this Friday afternoon of Tomorrow Be Televised. And welcome to those of you just joining us at the top of the hour. Simon Abbott with you live from New York. And if you'd like to respond to the following Takeaway of the Week segment, just call me, 646-652-2906, 646-652-2906. Numbers get anywhere, you're catching us across the country, around the globe, here on Blog Talk Radio, Speaker, Tuner Radio, or get into our chat room, not too late to do so, SimonApple04 by name. Find it at the homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. And don't forget, coming up on our next episode Monday afternoon, we'll have the executive director, new executive director of POV, the award-winning PBS independent documentary series, Erica Dilday. She was named to that position earlier this week, and this will be one of her first interviews since that appointment. She is the executive director of POV and its parent, American Documentary, Inc., which is based here in New York. It's Erica Dilday from POV with us, our lead guest, Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Be Televised. Now it's time for our regular Friday feature, the Takeaway of the Week, where we highlight a development that takes place during this week. You should take away from it as a possible future course of where TV is going and how it will impact what you watch and how you use television. And today, we could not notice, even more so, that there were not one but two developments that really could qualify for this feature. So we decided, let's double dip. Let's do two takeaways this week. The first takeaway is what I call the second coming of crowdfunding, blockchain, and cryptocurrency. Amazing to believe that back in 2015, because of President Obama's Jobs Act, that there was a new way emerging for people to try to fund television shows, and maybe more, called crowdfunding, or equity crowdfunding, where you could raise up to a certain amount of money through websites like Kickstarter, Seed and Spark, WeFunder, to get new projects off the ground. One of the big beneficiaries of this was Mystery Science Theater 3000. Back in 2015, using crowdfunding on Kickstarter, they made a big noise about trying to create new episodes, which they hadn't done in a while. We're talking about the Peabody winning program on Comedy Central, then on Sci-Fi. Well, thanks to a lot of Kickstarter people, they were able to raise over $5.5 million to make 13 new episodes of MST3K. And Netflix heard about the campaign. As it turned out, it became a two-season deal on Netflix, which ended up being not 13 episodes, but 20 episodes. However, in 2019, Netflix said, bye-bye, MST3K, no more new episodes. Well, a few weeks ago, MST3K decided, Joel Hodgson and crew, let's give it another go. And they have. And if you missed our beginning of the episode, our news notes section at the top, we told you that with 3 weeks to go, MST3K, which is not only raising money for new episodes, but for a new way to self-distribute the show called the Gizmoplex. It would be set up as a website, and it would also be available on mobile and on connected TVs and smart TV sets and devices. Well, so far, they have raised $2,892,857 with thousands of people joining in to fund. And that's more than half of their goal. So they now have the opportunity to establish this Gizmoplex, named after Gizmonic Institute, the headquarters of the folks behind MST3K, and also to create right now 5-6 new episodes. And that's more than halfway of their goal. They still have 2-3 weeks to get it all done, and it looks like they're on their way. But that's not all. We also told you about a project on our Tuesday episode called Clash TV, which is an interactive application or overlay that's currently running on Fubo TV coverage of mixed martial arts. They want to use the funding to expand way beyond just mixed martial arts coverage and do other sports, as well as offer it as for live entertainment events, even series. Well, so far, they have raised on WeFunder.com $476,659, and that is also above expectations. And we hear that there are some other people who are inspired by these results that also want to create TV projects and even TV services, live action, animated, otherwise, networks, or interactive projects of different kinds through Kickstarter-type crowdfunding or equity crowdfunding things. That's one side of the story. The other side of the story is the second coming of blockchain and cryptocurrency. 3 years ago, as we mentioned before, we covered this movement to try to use blockchain and cryptocurrency together to create, finance, market, promote, and self-distribute series without a middleman, without going to a broadcast network, a cable network, a multicast channel, a channel distributed on smart TV sets and smart devices, or a mega content service like Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, HBO Max, Peacock, etc. Well, because of some financial situations and because of the plunge of Bitcoin, the key cryptocurrency at the time, none of these ventures really got anywhere. And then came first of all, this formation of what we call NFTs, non-fungible tokens, sort of a spinoff of the token projects that these original cryptocurrency blockchain ventures were established through. And then came a venture called Starport, which over a Good Friday week, a few weeks ago this month, raised $50 million for 16 family-oriented episodic TV shows and films. Starport was put together by the combination of two companies, Immersive Artistry. It's an entertainment firm launched by Cary Grenat, a former head of Walden Media, family-friendly production company behind the Narnia films and other projects, and a financial group using blockchain and crypto called Gebo Group. We had Cary and James Wines from Gebo Group on our program this past Monday, and what they had to say was stunning. Basically, what they said was that what we did with these $50 million is just the starting point. There are major TV producers, content creators, and showrunners who are going to join us in raising their own blockchain cryptocurrency fueled ventures. And not just individual shows, but networks and maybe interactive TV, virtual, things like that. And while they can't talk about it in public now, they will as this year unfolds. Again, what Cary and James had to say in our conversation was stunning. In fact, our Starport episode this past Monday is our most popular episode so far of this month, and the replays are still coming in. And what I was left with is that, yes, blockchain cryptocurrency may finally have arrived for real. And the success of NFTs and the launch a few days ago of Coinbase on the stock exchanges, so far so good. could be very big proof of that. If you haven't heard that episode, I really suggest you do. And I'd love to hear what you think about what Carrie and James told me during the course of that conversation. So the takeaway of these two is this. Crowdfunding, back. You can raise more. It's no longer just episodic shows or individual specials. It could be television services. It could be foundation money for new television networks, interactive services, and much more. And the same thing with blockchain and cryptocurrency. Maybe, just maybe, the establishment of Coinbase, the fact it's no longer just Bitcoin, but Ethereum and Dogecoin and other such currencies, and the establishment of NFTs, including the NFT that we mentioned earlier called Aku, which anonymous content, no slouch in terms of TV film production, has gotten the rights to for TV and film projects from its artist, Micah Johnson, a former Major League Baseball player. If that doesn't tell you it legitimizes things, don't know what will. And here's the great news. We may have gotten out of the period where scams could pop up. Not saying permanently, and mostly. We are in a brand new ballgame here with crowdfunding, blockchain, cryptocurrency. And it's going to be real fun to see what surfaces. And we will stay in touch with Starport on their end with what they're doing. And if any of the showrunners, creators, et cetera, want to come on this program and talk to us about their efforts in crowdfunding, cryptocurrency, blockchain, we're all ears. It's going to be a fun story, and this is not going away. It's not going to go invisible. Both of these ways to get TV off the ground, the future TV we can maybe watch and use, especially in this era of plentiful TV, smart TV, diverse TV, interactive TV, is here to stay. So that's takeaway number one. Takeaway number two is the merger announcement of Univision, the major Spanish language television network, and entertainment complex in the United States, and Televisa, the Mexican organization that supplies Univision with most of its primetime programming. This is a huge deal. And I had the chance to hear the conference call for investors on Wednesday morning. And the people from both sides made it very clear, we are out to use this deal to cause the biggest global Netflix-like service for Spanish language television. And with our two entities together, we're going to get it done. No question about that. They have the infrastructure and the resources to do it. And Univision is already off to the races with its Spanish language mega content service, Prende TV, which launched earlier this month, and already is getting major advertiser support and major viewer support. However, there's one thing that Univision and Televisa, with this deal, did not address. And it's the, in my mind, most critical topic that's long running in this world of Spanish language television that I've covered, that I've had the great fortune to cover for over 40 years. And that is, when it comes to Univision, the ongoing lack of scripted television, weekly, nightly, daily, all different genres, produced in the United States by Spanish language content makers, writers, producers, directors, actors, etc. More than 40 years after Univision was founded, and in spite of a gigantic leap in advertiser support, Univision continues not to have Spanish language U.S. produced programming in the scripted arena. It's still a Televisa ballgame. It's still Televisa supplying it all. And I think it's high time that Univision and Televisa, now with this merger, address this. Is this merger going to finally open the door for for Spanish language content makers in this country to produce in this country, whether it's in New York, Los Angeles, Texas, Florida, Albuquerque, New Mexico, elsewhere, and to show programming that reflects the U.S. Latino marketplace, culture, lifestyle today. Or is this deal basically shutting the door on this forever? I would highly suggest that Univision and Televisa address this, and the sooner they do, the better. Because frankly, I know the talent is out there that wants to do it, whether it is from the major production companies, from Warner Brothers to Lionsgate to MGM to Paramount, to independent production companies. More and more of them are being put together by U.S.-based Latinos. They've got the opportunity to do so. And by the way, Univision, with its realigned management over the last year, has got the talent to make it work. Wade Davis, from what I understand, the former Viacom senior official, from what I hear, is a real great talent. And they just hired Donna Speciality from Turner, one of the best cable advertising sales executives, who is really on a tear in terms of trying to get the majority of national advertisers to get into Spanish language TV, which they currently are not. According to their special pre-upfront presentation, which I did a column about for Media Village, you can see it at MediaVillage.com, Speciality noted that out of nearly 2,000 national advertisers who are on the course of a year on broadcast, cable, other television, English language TV, only about 400 now are regular advertisers of Spanish language television, whether Univision, Telemundo, et cetera. And I know she's on the warpath for that. And Univision will have their regular upfront, their virtual upfront, will be next month. And I would strongly suggest that Davis and Special and everyone else and Televisa address this issue once and for all, because they certainly have the vehicles to make it happen, whether it's through Univision, Unimas, Galavision, their broadcasting cable networks, and Prende TV. And I would have to think that Prende TV at some point would produce shows based in the United States. Peacock is already doing it through Telemundo, with one series already on its way to being produced. And I know that Telemundo, which has been a leader in terms of trying to get Spanish language U.S. produced television, scripted TV off the ground, has had issues in the last year because of the coronavirus pandemic impacting its main headquarters, where their studio complex is in Florida, in Miami Beach. But now that Florida has reopened in a big degree, Telemundo is getting things revved up. They have the romantic comedy that's now playing on their schedule in prime time, and they have other shows that they are going to be doing down the road for the rest of this year in 2022. So my big takeaway out of this Univision Televisa deal is there's some big things in the works. And it's high time that Univision and Televisa finally talk to the press, to the ad community, and more important, to the creative community, and say, this is where we stand in terms of scripted TV that you want to do in Spanish on our networks, on our services, current and future. It's time to get this issue out in front and licked. And if it ends up that Televisa is basically going to be the scripted profit supplier from now to kingdom come, say so. So it gives the Spanish language creative community the opportunity to say, okay, we'll go elsewhere. And I think that, frankly, would be a detriment to Univision. I really do. Univision and Televisa have a golden opportunity to finally trigger a major, major movement of U.S.-produced Spanish-language television scripted, including genre television. Wouldn't it be nice to see a science fiction series being done in Spanish, a Sword and Sorcery, a Game of Thrones-like show, or a space adventure, or a fantasy, or a show like American Horror Story? Wouldn't it be great to see that? I think Univision and Televisa should really take the lead on it. So I hope they address this. Fingers crossed. And that's our takeaways of the week. Once again, a big thank you to our guest today, Mark Bishop from Marvel Media, and their BYU TV comedies coming up on Monday night, The Parker Andersons and Amelia Parker, and Sherry Chung, the composer of Kung Fu and Riverdale on the CW. Pleasure to have both of them on. Thank them for coming aboard, and thank you for tuning in. We're back on Monday, and coming up on Monday, our lead guest will be, in one of her first interviews, she's taking on this role, the new executive director of POV on PBS, Erica Dilde. If you came in late on today's program, want to catch up an episode you missed, as always, go to our homepage. It's there waiting for you, www.blogtalkradio.com/televised. It's www.blogtalkradio.com/televised. And as always, check out our podcast. They're available to you 24/7 at iTunes, Apple TV, Spreaker Podcast, TuneIn.com, iHeartRadio.com, Verbal, and Amazon Music. And if there is a podcast site like Spotify or Westwood One, et cetera, you'd like to hear our show on, let them know and have them contact me, and we'll make something happen for sure. Love to hear what you thought about today's show. What's your thoughts about the future of television? I'm curious what you have to say about our takeaways of the week, about the Univision Televisa deal and its impact on possible Spanish-language scripted television in the U.S., and about crowdfunding and cryptocurrency and NFTs and what that could make possible for television. Email me, SimonApple04@yahoo.com. That's SimonApple04@yahoo.com. I do respond to your emails in 24 hours. That's how you get involved with our classic trivia question of the week. And if you have, by the way, an idea for a show-to-know feature where we highlight a program that's worth your while and thinks should get more attention on television than it does, put it in there. And if we do, use that suggestion on the air. You get the credit. And don't forget, you can also find me on Facebook and LinkedIn. Follow me on Twitter at UBC Simon, TWBT. That's UBC Simon, TWBT. And don't forget to check out my Media Village column at MediaVillage.com. We also have some of our Tomorrow Be Televised. So check it out, www.MediaVillage.com. However you communicate, we'd love to communicate back with you. Why? Because more than ever, what you say matters. The views expressed here are those of the participants. I would say those of Blog Talk Radio, Speaker, TuneIn Radio, or other distributors of this program. Our production associate is Mandolin. Andy Toe is Blog Talk Radio's general manager, with Jay Sonnenberg, head of content. The co-founders of this enterprise are Alan Levy and Bob Chowish. Tomorrow Be Televised is brought to you by Audible.com and Amazon Division. Remember, Audible transformed the way you hear the world. For a free audiobook or two, 1 month trial and more, it's audibletrial.com/televised. For Tomorrow Be Televised, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for your listening. Have a wonderful weekend ahead. We are back with you on Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific. You know where. Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, TuneIn Radio, Verbal, Amazon Music, and the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. Whatever you're up to between now and then, please make it safe, make it great. If you haven't taken the vaccine yet, do consider taking it, because it could be the link to getting us back to the next normal and licking this pandemic to kingdom come now and forever. Until the next time, stay well and stay tuned.